This week on the show, we have using Git offline, a little how-to for you, or if you haven't known how to use that, check this out. Then you have a big and very extensive tutorial for you, how you make your own email server to be a bit more independent in your own little world or part of the network. Quiz, which is a tool that Rob Norris wrote, a tool for rapid OpenZFS development, how you can also configure OpenZFS for NVMe databases from the people that do the Let's Encrypt, Mirroring OmniOS, the complete guide, part 1, we present to you, as well as installing OpenBSD 7.4 on Division 5, revision 1.2a. Terminal latency is what we also cover and more in this week's episode of BSD. BSD Now, episode 553, Terminal Latency, Not Velocity. This is BSD Now, recorded on the 21st of March, 2024. This episode of BSD Now is brought to you by Tarsnap. Go to tarsnap.com/BSDnow to find online backup for truly paranoid people. And if you want to support this show in one way or the other, check out our Patreon page at patreon.com/BSDnow. And we thank you in advance for that. Hi, we are your hosts, Benedikt Reuschling.
And Tom Jones.
Yeah, we are here. We are wishing you a nice week. Hopefully yours has started well. We're still in the week where Asia BSD Con is, where we record this episode. By the time you listen to it, it's all over, and they probably have published a couple of things from the Dev Summit or blog posts or from the conference even, like papers. So we're excited, as you are, to get those in the future episode. But for now, we will be contenting ourselves with this one. And it also is nice because the headlines start today with using Git offline.
So first up, we have an article from James Gibbard, I hope, from gibbard.me, James Notes Computers. And this is titled Using Git Offline. Some companies use an isolated network or even the complete lack of a network as a security measure to protect from unauthorized access. Working on these systems can be a struggle, but it's still possible. And perhaps even more important, to use proper version control like Git. Yeah, don't use Perforce, that's madness. By design, Git works quite happily with no remote repository. You can branch, stage, and commit files just like normal. Make dir test repo, cd test repo, git init, touch text file, git add all, git commit, blah, blah, blah. This works great if just a single machine is used for development, but this is often not the case. Working with multiple machines using a USB memory stick or a hard drive. When security policy allows read-write access to a memory stick or a portable hard drive, a remote repository can be created on the device. On one development machine, mount the memory stick, cd path memory stick, make dir repo name.git, cd repo name.git, git init dash dash bare. Navigate to the repo that is to be shared, add the remote repository on the memory stick, and push the changes. Some git commands. The remote can be called anything. It doesn't have to be called origin. Unmount the memory stick and mount it on another development machine. If the development machine does not have a copy of the repository on it already, then a clone can be used. If there is already a copy on the repository, then the stick can be used as a remote with push, pull, fetch changes. From now on, use Git as normal and make sure that whenever a Git pull, fetch, or push is performed, the memory stick is mounted on the machine. Ensure the memory stick is part of the backup routine. Working with multiple machines using CDs and DVDs. Okay. In a lockdown environment, in lockdown development environments, memory sticks may be blocked. Using Git is still possible, but a little more inconvenient. Git will happily fetch changes from one copy of a repo to another. One option, then, is to simply copy the directory containing the local Git repository to another computer via CD or other media and make changes and commits like normal on both machines. When you want to combine changes, select one machine to perform the merge and copy in the other repository over to this machine. To pull changes in the current branch, use Git pull directory to path to repo. Alternatively, you can fetch the changes and create a new branch to store them, git fetch. At this point, create a new copy of the repository with merges and move it over to other machines. Pull the latest change into other repositories, or if desired, simply replace the whole repository with a new copy. Obviously, this is far from ideal. Copying the whole repository directory will include personal settings and files excluded in the .gitignore file. To mitigate this, git clone could be used to duplicate the repository rather than just copying it. But a much better option is to use git bundle. A git bundle allows for part of all of a repository to be compressed into a single file in a format that git is able to clone and fetch from. The workflow looks very similar to before, but instead of copying the whole repository directory, a git bundle is created. On the first machine, create a bundle using git bundle create repo.name bundle --all. The --all option bundles the entire repository, including all branches and tags. Specific branches or tags can be selected using -b branch name or -t tag name. Copy reponame.bundle files to another computer to clone the repository. Changes and commits can be made on any of the computers like before. One machine must be selected to perform the merge. On the non-merging machine, make sure all changes are committed and created using git bundle create reponame bundle --all. For larger repositories, it is a good idea to only bundle part of the repository to avoid transferring more data than needed. For example, to only include 5 commits on the master branch, use git bundle create reponame -5 master. It's important that there are no gaps between commits in the bundle and commits on the repository where the merging will occur or the process will fail. Creating a local remote repository. Bundle solves the problem of synchronizing Git repos without a network, but we are still left with multiple computers all likely to be slightly out of sync with each other. If a new developer joins a team, who do they copy the repository from? The best option is to select one development machine that will act as a server. A bare Git repository can be created on this development machine in addition to a local clone of the repo where the developer will actually work. The distributed nature of Git allows it to work well without a central server. While the options presented will never be as convenient as simply pushing to GitHub, they will beat the alternative of main v1 final version with Bob's extra patch final version. Oh, that's what I call my branches. This is madness, but cool. It's wild.
We should actually mention when we see Git that we have an upcoming FreeBSD Journal article or issue about development workflow where Git is one topic. I know this because I wrote the article. Sorry, shameless self-publishing, self-advertising. It's coming in the next couple of months, so we will probably cover it here. Going back to our episode, next up is make your own email server with FreeBSD, OpenSMTPD, RSpamD, and Dovecot included. This is part one. This is from the IT notes in the itnotes-dragas.net. Stefano Marinelli wrote this and it's 24 minutes long. Definitely check. Oh, nice word count here. 4,444 words. I wonder if you optimized towards this.
It says 4,416 words for me.
Is it? Did you do a separate word count?
That's what it says. Oh, okay. It's been updated.
Okay. Anyway, so he has an extensive tutorial. We probably couldn't cover it at all in the whole length, but definitely check out, especially when part two comes out. So this is a whole big setup to do your own email server. So he provides the initial, why should you do this? Don't we all have an email provider by now? But he also goes into decentralization and the reasons for it, because that's where the web started from, and be your own host and in control of many of these things is good motivation, actually, since you provide or you prevent certain vendor logins, especially with email, which is just ubiquitous still. And the setup planning goes for this. Over the years, they've used many different SMTP servers, originally the good old SendMail. Subsequently, and for many years, Stefano used XIM, also because it was the default system in Debian. Then he migrated almost all setups towards PostFix, probably the most widespread SMTP server on the net, and he never had any particular problems. In recent years, he has decided to use, when possible, the excellent OpenSMTPD. Being based on OpenBSD and easily installable on other operating systems, it shares the primary concepts of security and reliability of OpenBSD, as well as the syntax, both in command line and configuration files, of all other OpenBSD tools. So for this type of setup, they will use OpenSMTPD. So the choice to use FreeBSD rather than OpenBSD stems from two main factors. The first is the possibility of dividing into jails, physically separating the various services and minimizing dependencies. And the second is possibility of using ZFS, which all the advantages it brings. Ability to take snapshots, ability to perform backups quickly and efficiently, and ability to migrate entire jails without particular problems. The other tools used is RSpamD, one of the best integrated systems for checking incoming mail. Customizable, adaptable, and modular, it also provides interesting monitoring systems on the type of incoming and outgoing mail. Redis, which will be used to RSpamD to manage its memory, quote-unquote. And Dovecot and Sieve for delivering mail to local mailboxes, as well as allowing remote email consultation via IMAP and enabling the setting of rules, thanks to the pigeonhole sieve. Okay, the users of the mail server would not be physical users of the server itself, but virtual users totally unrelated to system users. So installation and configuration, they won't describe FreeBSD installation and configuring procedure because that would blow the article even more out of proportion. But in their case, they activated VPS and Hetzner in a situation the smallest of the available ARM servers, and it's possible to efficiently manage a mail server for several users on a machine costing less than €4 a month. ZFS can be useful, but it's not necessary for this type of setup. Okay. Then it has a subheading about encryption or not, to encrypt or not to encrypt. A subsequent assessment is whether to use encryption for the data connections to and from the mail server will always be encrypted, but it's also possible to encrypt the data at rest. In the case of FreeBSD, it's possible to enable encryption to the entire installation. The entire virtual disk will be encrypted, and ZFS or UFS will be created on top of it. Or in case of ZFS, it will be possible to encrypt only the root data set of the jails, the one that will be used by BastilleBSD. And so he discusses a little bit the pros and cons of both. And you can always, of course, create a ZFS encrypted data set. Then proceed from there to create on that the Bastille jails to do that. So he describes how to do that with ZFS create, because you can only add encryption on a new data set and not on an existing one, and also how to load the key for that. Okay, then configuring FreeBSD and BastilleBSD, he provides a couple of RCconf lines for setting up the DHCP and the VTNet. That's the particularities of that hosting provider from Hetzner. I guess that's not for everyone. IPv6 default router, and that gets his network flag packets flowing. He also sets IP forwarding and the same for IPv6. So after the reboot, you can do ping6google.com. Isn't there a unified ping command by now that does ping6 and ping4? Right. Okay, so that's all. He does FreeBSD update fetch install to get latest updates. And fine. He also adds a couple of lines to loader.conf to disable the TSO and LRO of his network card on VTNet, and as well as the checksum. So that's probably a configuration to make it a bit faster. Bridget Firewall, for some time now, he's been favoring the use of VNet jails for these type of setups, and he creates exactly this for his jails that host the mail setup. Everything is provided, of course, in the article as you know, parts of config that you can just copy and adapt, not don't just copy it and use it. And he provides the full pfconf to filter and create a couple of rules to, you know, the usual ports for mail, and also SSH and port 80 for the web mail interface. And so he catches a couple of bad people on the net already this way. Then he creates an Nginx proxy in Redis jail. So this is done to get the web mail going, I'm fairly sure. Then he creates or downloads the certbot files to get the SSL updates or the certificates, and he details the setup of this. Then he runs Redis and then set up the actual mail jail. It's time to create a jail with the main services. So this is the mail jail, another Bastille jail, and he sets this up as well and installs a bunch of packages, RSpamD, OpenSMTPD, as we mentioned earlier. There's also OpenSMTPD extras and OpenSMTPD extras-table-passwd. So that's some extra additional packages that you may want to look at, as well as Dovecot, Dovecot pigeonhole, and RSpamD filters for OpenSMTPD. Then he gives it a host name that he can remember, mail.example.com in our case, and sets up the Let's Encrypt for that so that we also have the particularities of that. Due to spammers who, year after year, become increasingly aggressive, many mail servers require perfect configuration of the main server or sender authentication methodologies. Today, the main and now necessary under penalty of message non-delivery are SPF, DKIM, and DMARC. Michael W. Lucas has a book soon out about how to set up a proper mail server, and I'm fairly sure he covers those two in those three, in detail. But until then, we have this setup here, and he provides the DKIM setup, as well as the SPF record, as well as the DMARC record in DNS. Okay, then he creates a user for this mail server that has no login set as their shell, but is running all the services. Okay, then he creates the SMTPD conf, which again is similar in configuration like a pfconf or other OpenBSD services. So I haven't looked at that too much yet, but I probably will to get a bit more familiar with these kinds of services. Then he connects Redis to it, then figures out the DKIM signing. I'm scrolling just a little bit further down so that people don't get confused. And the sieve configuration is also done, and you can definitely find a lot of information in there, and the example configs he provides are good to just take and adapt. And at the end, you have at least part one of the mail server setup, and there's part two, but we probably cover this in a future episode of BSD Now. Right?
Cool. Is that Stefano from BSD Cafe? I think it might
That's him, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. He has a bunch of good how-tos, yeah.
Okay, that's with the headlines headed out, now it's time for the news roundup. And first in the news roundup, we have a blog post from Rob Norris at despairlabs.com. And it's Quiz, a tool for rapid OpenZFS development. And Rob writes, my preferred programming style is highly interactive and exploratory, which requires a fast edit compile test cycle. But then a year ago, I started working on OpenZFS, which is a big chunk of kernel code. Kernel code means developing on either real hardware or in a virtual machine, which tend to be awkward or to get real code onto, and then being kernel code, it's pretty easy to crash, wedge, or otherwise damage the kernel, requiring a reboot. I wanted a way to work on OpenZFS just like I'd work on any other program, to make a change, compile it, run it, and see what happens. I'd heard a little about micro VMs being able to boot a kernel to user space in a fraction of a second, so I decided to look into it more and see if I could make something like that work for me. As it turns out, it can be made to work and work well. The unbelievably stupid name Quiz is what I came up with, and I'm now compiling and running OpenZFS and test programs with many tens of times a day on VMs that live for seconds at a time. Micro machines. First, we need a VM that we can start and stop quickly. The venerable QEMU has a micro VM machine type designed explicitly to start quickly. It does this by leaving out things you'd normally find in a real computer or a full machine emulation, like the PCI bus. Fewer devices means fewer things to initialize at boot. Then we need a custom kernel. The typical kernel comes with your favorite Linux distribution has support for everything, and we'll spend lots of time hunting around to figure out what hardware exists. Since we know it won't find them, we can save a lot of time by only including support for hardware we know exists. The other thing we need to do is build everything, and we need into the kernel binary. A generic kernel is usually accompanied by a minimal root file system, the initrd, which has all the driver modules and startup scripts inside. This is all in service of hardware detection, which we don't really need. As well as adding more time while it runs and eventually transfers control to the real root file system, by compiling that into the kernel, we only need the kernel file itself to get started. However, we still need to keep module support because we want to load OpenZFS later as a module rather than compiling the kernel every time. As for devices, we don't actually need much. CPU, memory, a console, and some storage, which we'll get to later, it ends up being a pretty hefty command line, but nothing that it doesn't easily get scripted. Quiz ships with a program, Quiz Prepare Kernel, that takes care of downloading a kernel, building it, and getting ready to go. It's also a set of kernel configs for different kernel minor versions to make them work well in a Quiz VM environment. Taken together, we can boot a machine to /sbin init in a second or two. A big ball of files. ever thought, even though we don't need an initrd, we still need files inside our VM. We need something to run. In a regular VM, that's likely to be a plain old disk image, but we're not building a regular VM, but rather something that provides an environment for us to quickly test our code and then disappear without a trace. We need something a bit more complicated. It's actually a question of separating what data we need in our VM by some notion of permanence. Quiz does this by building a complete file system out of layers using Linux's file system overlay feature. At the bottom, we need all the basic trappings of a Unix system to just operate things at all, a shell and standard tools, basic system services, debug tools, and so on. This layer is effectively immutable. We can build it once and reuse it over and over again. We use mmdebstrap to create the bottom layer. It builds a very minimal Debian-based system with a bunch of additional packages we need and emits an ext4 image. Into that, we add a tiny stage1/sbin init, which creates a layered file system of all the pieces, and then jumps into the second stage to do the rest of the setup and run what other test program we're running. This two-stage process is mostly there because the disk image is a little awkward to regenerate, so we want to reduce how often we need to do it. The disk image itself is mostly there because it's the easiest thing to get out of mmdebstrap, and means we don't have to worry about things like permissions. Above that, we need places to put our local programs in that we modify between runs. This includes the outputs from our OpenZFS build with whatever we're working on and any test program and other stuff we might want to modify on the host, but have present inside the VM. The middle layers are just regular files and host directories, which are exposed to the VM as 9 PFS shares, which QEMU creates and the guest kernel can mount. They are kept separate as each has a different purpose and is managed by a different process on the host. Init gets managed in the VM as /.quiz, and this is where quiz starter process creates a set of scripts and config files needed to get the VM up and into the desired state and run the wanted program. System is mounted as an overlay on root, the main install target for OpenZFS or whatever other thing you're doing. User restored is a second overlay on root for user scripts and other test programs you might want to edit directly rather than install from another system. Finally, at the top, we put a RAM disk where any and all modifications to the file system go. This allows the VM to produce output write logs and modify existing files and disappear without a trace afterwards. The init1 script in the bottom image assembles all these pieces before bouncing into init2 to start the system. Here it is enough to show there's just one apparent file system. It does df-a. All this gives the programs inside the VM a nice, uncomplicated file system they don't need to know anything about. No special paths or off-limit areas, no restrictions on writing. This is good. We want to test things for real without any special treatment. In its simplest mode, the VM just drops into a shell. That's nice, but not very useful. I want to be able to run a program almost exactly as if I ran it locally, which means just being able to type it. But also, I want to be able to run different programs, and that can mean different environments. So we need a way to set those up. This is the job of the main quiz program on the host and the init2 script inside the VM. Init2 does some basic common setup, like setting the host name, starting UDEV, and some other environment bits. It ends with starting tiny, init program that performs the duties required from PID1, which then runs whatever program we ask for, or bash if we didn't. If we do request a program, quiz creates a tiny script fragment /.quiz run before QEMU is started and puts the requested program and args into it. Init2 looks for this and asks tiny to run it if it exists. Profiles can extend this further. Adding a profile will make additional setup happen in quiz on the host and then additional setup inside the VM. The two halves of this can work together to get the environment ready before the user program or the shell is called. The ZFS profile is very simple. In quiz itself, it calls dep mod to ensure the various module dep files are updated properly for the latest build, so it can't run inside the VM because the modules are in the system layer. Then from init2, we do mod probe ZFS. All this is to make sure that OpenZFS is ready to go when the program shell starts. Change the system. So we have everything to play with OpenZFS in development, but we still need to get our change in there. In theory, this is simple. OpenZFS is built by AutoTools, and all we have to do is give the system shares an alternate install prefix, and off we go. Well, that's the idea anyway, but it's not quite that simple. Technically, what we're doing a form of cross-compilation. Because even though the architecture is the same, build and run hosts are different. OpenZFS can't be cross-compiled reliably, but at least in this case, the host and build environments are similar enough that we can get what we need with a bunch of extra options. Both configure and make install need adjusting, so there's a helper script quiz build ZFS to take care of those. I don't love this part, to be honest, but it is going to take improvements to ZFS's build system to do better. I've got some ideas for tighter integrations, but I haven't thought those through, but for the moment, this is quite fun. So once the quiz environment is set up, a typical open ZFS development session is /autodengen.sh, quiz build ZFS, hack, 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 make-j5, quiz build ZFS make install, quiz-p, blah, blah, blah. It's a few more steps than I'd like, but it really gets in my way, and I did little tweaks and changes as I go. It's made me hugely productive without needing any special hardware or long boot times, and I'm pretty pleased with it. I've got a ton more ideas. I do have the start of a multi-arch version done so that I can run a QMU for a different architecture. This is important because OpenZFS aims to be endian agnostic, so being able to test on big endian architecture is helpful. I also want to do a similar setup for FreeBSD so I can check OpenZFS changes for both major platforms, but this is more complicated. If cross-compiling for another architecture is a challenge, cross-compiling for another OS is even more exciting. Still, at the end of the day, it's all code and it's just a matter of getting it right. If you're into doing OpenZFS or any kind of kernel dev on Linux, then quiz might just be the thing. It's a bit rough in places, but I'm using it hundreds of times a week and the proof is in the eating. Every single commit I've made in OpenZFS since the start of last year has seen the inside of a quiz VM at least once. You can get it from my GitHub, robn/quiz. Thanks, Rob. This is amazing. I want this. But...
And you, on your blog, you wrote that you will be at AsiaBSDCon giving two presentations. So good luck for those. And I hope you have a good way of networking with other BSD folks there.
I mean, if he hears this, he's already done it. So
yeah, well, I guess. But well, of you. It's not for lack of trying. So this is that story. And the next we have for you is configuring OpenZFS for NVMe databases. So this comes from the folks that are doing the Let's Encrypt, it turns out. And they have a ZFS data store from MariaDB. And they published on GitHub how they configure that and some of the other settings they do. So this documents the settings we use at Let's Encrypt to create ZFS backing storage from MariaDB or MariaDB and the tips and best practices that led us here. So the storage priorities. Our priorities are in order. First, integrity. Second, performance. Third, durability. Our data must be correct. Integrity is our service's most important property. We must change settings which might defeat ZFS' inherent high integrity. We've had stubborn performance problems because of our data center's large size, schema, and access patterns. We ran out of improvements to those properties that we could make in the short term. This made it a high priority to wring as much performance out of our database servers as we safely could. Our primary database server rapidly replicates to two others, including two locations, and is backed up daily. The most business and compliance critical data is also locked separately outside of our database stack. As long as we can maintain durability for long enough to evacuate the primary write role to a healthier database server, that is enough. Accordingly, we are tuning ZFS and MariaDB for performance over durability, avoiding only the more dangerous trade-offs. So preparing the drives, many modern storage devices can present different sector sizes, LBA formats to the host system. Only one or none will be the internal best performing sector size. This is often the largest sector size they can natively support, e.g. 4KN. They have a bunch of footnotes there, but we leave you to read them yourself. We currently use Intel NVMe drives, which have a changeable variable sector size. Intel's online documentation and specifications don't list the sector size options for the P4610 model we use, but scanning it showed us two possible values, 0, which is 512 bytes, or 1, which is 4K. Flashbench results strongly suggest that the internal sector size is 8K, so they have the first to delete the whole thing. This is careful. This erases data. If you do this, you will end up with nothing. So they do Intel mass start, Intel SSD, the drive index. So they have from 0 to 23 in this case. Def NVMe format, LBA format equals 1, secure erase setting 0, protection information equals 0 as well, and metadata settings also. Then they do sudo Intel mass show that this to display, the sector size, and internal SSD, the drive index. Okay, next to the ZFS kernel module settings. Almost all of the I.O. to our datasets will be done by the InnoDB database engine, which has its own prefetching logic. Since ZFS prefetching would be redundant and less well optimized, we disabled it, so they set ZFS prefetch disabled to 1. Building the VDEVs pool and datasets. Basic concepts from the bottom up. So these are basic stuff that everyone is familiar with, who have heard about ZFS. What is a pool? What is a VDEV? And stuff like that. What is a data set? We match our drive's best performing 8K sector size. So they do A shift equals 13. And they want to automatically activate newly inserted replacements for failed drives. So they do auto replace equals on. And use dev disk by ID paths to identify the drives in case they've swapped around to different drive bays or the OS's device naming schema changes somehow. We use a RAID-1+0 in order to achieve the best possible performance without being vulnerable to a single drive failure. They balance VDEVs across controllers, buses, and backplane segments in order to improve throughput and fault tolerance. So they do zpool create -o a shift 13 auto replace on as mentioned. Then they call it DB01 because, well, it's a database host. And then they mirror their particular drives, two of them, to get the RAID 10 and many of those more. So always mirror of two disks. And they also provide two spare drives. Then they have a bunch of information about the parent data set. So these properties are inherited by child data sets unless overwritten. They set the A time to off, compression to LZ4, and primary cache to metadata, as well as the record size to 128K. Because ZFS default record size is 128K, is appropriate for medium sequential writes and general use, including database backups, which may also use this data set. Then they set the XATTRs to SA, which are the extended attributes, to reduce I.O. overhead for SE Linux. And so they mentioned something without the flag. Even the root user attempting to set an ACL on a folder or file on a ZFS mount will receive operation not permitted, according to the ZFS man page. So then they provide a ZFS create command, so mount point slash data store, A time off, and compression LZ4, denote size to auto, primary cache metadata, record size is 128K, as mentioned, XATTR is SA, and ACL type is POSIX-ACL on DB01/MySQL. All right, then they talk about the ZIL. They're not using one because their drives are the same fast speed. We still hint to ZFS that throughput is more important than latency for their workload, so they do log bias equals throughput. In MariaDB, they have the following settings. InnoDB _double_write0, because ZFS writes are atomic by design, and they've aligned the page record sizes, so they disable the double write buffer in the database. We also store tables in individual files, so much easier backup, recovery, or relocation. So they do InnoDB file per table equals on, and reduce writes by setting the redo log file to InnoDB log write ahead to 16384, which is 16 kilobytes. They mentioned that some articles suggest using a larger block size here for the logs, but MySQL caps this value at the table space's record size. They disable AIO, asynchronous IO, which performs poorly on Linux. So this is set InnoDB use native AIO to 0, InnoDB use atomic writes equals 0, and that should be the solution for that. They disable also proactively flushing pages in the same extent. Because the group writes are not an issue with aligned page record sizes, InnoDB flush neighbors equals 0 is the setting for that. Then two more. They increase target and max IOPS above the defaults, InnoDB IO capacity to 1,000. That avoids excessive SSD wear because the defaults were tuned for spinning disks, which I don't use. So that's this idea. And also InnoDB IO capacity max is 2,500. Oh, they striked out the last item here about the checksummings, but they say checksums are required as of MariaDB 10.6. So that can't be disabled totally. Okay. They have a bunch of references for things they use, but they run regular scrubs as well, integrity checks on the zpools, and monitor zpools health using the Prometheus node exporter. That's it.
Okay, next up we have a blog post from Antranig Vartanian, Mirroring OmniOS, The Complete Guide, Part 1, Chapter 1. I know The Complete Guide and Part 1 are oxymorons, but hey, be happy that I'm publishing in parts, otherwise I completely ignored this blog post. 2 weeks ago, I started to play with Lumos again. I was speaking with a friend and we were sharing our frustrations regarding open source contribution. We write the code, we submit, we get feedback, we submit again, and we're ghosted. It's like LinkedIn or Tinder version of software engineering. I need to interrupt here because this is very deep to my heart. I think I've realized recently that programming is fun and software engineering is just the absolute worst.
Yeah, they usually come together, but you can avoid one without the other.
No, like running a successful business and paying tax are very different things. You don't need to do both.
Yeah. Of course. Yeah. One is unavoidable, I hear. Death and taxes.
Oh, man. Software engineering is just the worst. I had to set up a Git format patch this week.
Depends on the type of software engineering. There's a couple of models out there, I hear.
If your model of software engineering is like writing stuff on a CD, I'm actually closer to that than anything else. It seems much better than...
Okay.
Oh, yeah, what a great patch. Why don't you also change this entire subsystem? No, this two-line change will solve my problem. I don't need to do all the homework. Anyway, then I asked him about his best open-source experience, and he told me, a Lumos, of course. I was amazed. I thought you had to be very technical in order to even build a Lumos, but it turns out they have amazing documentation of building a Lumos and OmniOS and a Lumos distribution. Has done the work to make sure the system can be self-hosted, the OS can build itself. So I decided to fire up OmniOS on our Hackerspace server. I think it's hackerspace.am. Hackerspace server running FreeBSD inside a Beehive VM. The installation went smoothly, but the IPS packages were slow to download. And I might be wrong, please correct me if I am, but IPS doesn't seem to be keeping a local copy of the files. It just always downloads. Is that configurable? Regardless, I thought the best way to contribute is to advocate. In order to do that, I needed to make sure that IPS servers were fast in Armenia, hence the mirroring project started. Obey requirements. Here is some terminology I will use in this blog post just for on the same page. OmniOS is in a Lumos distribution. Origin is the origin of the packages. Local is a copy. Repository is a collection of software. Core is a core repository. Extras is the extra repository. IPS or package is the image packaging system. Zone, a Lumos zone similar to FreeBSD Jails Linux containers. CH root running on OmniOS. Now that we're on the same page, let's talk about a setup and what we need. Internet connection. Who knew? A domain name. Yep. Package.omnios.lumos. .operating system.computer.internet. Yeah, sorry. Package.omnios.olumos.am. Yes, I'm luckily like that. A publicly accessible IP address, a server. Yep. Storage. Definitely need that. Before we set up our mirror, let's make sure we have good infrastructure that we can maintain. Here's what we'll create. A zone that will act as a HTTP server running Nginx at 10.10.0.80. A zone that will do the mirroring, a DOM switch, ZFS datasets for each core and repositories for each release. Please note that there are many ways to do this. For example, having everything in a global zone running IPS mirroring and Nginx in a single zone, but not using Etherstub at all, I'd like to set up so as to grow in the future. From now on, so there's some prompts. So we set up an Etherstub, set up zones, do ZFS, configure the system. And then there's more steps. There's a lot of steps to setting up mirroring, which you should go and read the article for, but you're not going to get a lot in a podcast listening to me read them. And a final note, this has been an amazing experience, which people don't normally say about open source software. Since I started using OmniOS 2 weeks ago, I've set up the mirror. I've installed two OmniOS deployments on production for two organizations. And I talked about it during Armenian Hackers podcast radio. With this mirror completely set up, I can advocate even more. I'd like to send my thanks and later my money to the OmniOS team for the amazing work they're doing. Special thanks to Andy F for answering all of my questions. And Nirak for pushing me to try more Lumos in my life and everyone who contributed to the docs and blog posts that I used. I'll leave some links below. Finally, for the coming two posts, I'll talk about mirroring and the package repository run by SmartOS at MNX. Thank you for reading Thank you for the Lumos community for being so nice. Thanks for writing this. I like blog posts.
Very good. So that goes into our next item, which is installing OpenBSD 7.4 on a Vision 5 2 revision 1.2a for the people who take care about these particularities. From last year, December 22, but nevertheless still valid and accurate, goes like this. Linux feels a bit sluggish on the Vision 5 2, so they wanted to install OpenBSD on their board since a RISC-V port is available. The blog is here on quozul.dev. Requirements. For this serial to USB adapter, the eMMC module minus the VA001-32 gig, SD card and the Vision 5 2 itself, that's the Vision 1.2a from the Kickstarter campaign. Installing OpenBSD on it. So preparing the boot drive, first step, download the image from the OpenBSD website, then flash it onto the SD card. Then you'll have to get a copy of the DTB file, which is not in the GitHub release, but RPX made a great script to build it from source. They link to that particular from the blog. Mount the AFI partition from the SD card and add it in the root of the partition. It should end up being something like the following. So you have EFI, below that there's boot, and below boot is boot risk v64.efi. And below EFI is yet another file where that's the DTB file. If you have a version 1.3 off the board, you have to use the other DTB file, 1.3. That's the version in the name, so be careful with that. Unmount and disconnect the SD card when done. Booting into the installer, insert the SD card in your Vision 5 board. Make sure you are connected and the board with a serial connection to interrupt the boot process when you see the prompt, hit any key to stop auto boot, because then we can now load the DTB and OpenBSD kernel from the SD card. They provide the load instructions. They're a bit verbose, so we need to type the whole long file names, but once you're there, it starts. Then you can install the OS. Following the installation process, if you normally would, they had troubles using CloudFirst DNS, but using FTP, fronbsd.org worked without any issues. Once the install is done, you can reboot. Booting then into OpenBSD. To simply boot into OpenBSD in the current state, you can swap the first with a zero in for the MMC module and the second command. So there you just load a different start partition. Moving the DTB file off the SD card. If you wish to remove the SD card, you can remove or you can move the DTB file onto the eMMC module, and they provide instructions how to do that. Then it's fairly straightforward, creating the mount points and mount the partition as well, and copy the files and unmount them. And that gives you the next part, tweaking the U-boot to automatically boot into OpenBSD. They provide the run command to do exactly that. And then you set a new boot command from eMMC. This is basically the previous command saved in the environment variable, so you don't have to type it every time. And now that they are using 0:1 for the DTB file, we move that now from the SD card to the eMMC storage. And when you reboot, the board should automatically boot into OpenBSD. They provided the resources they used to get there, including OpenBSD's website, rvspace.org, as well as GitHub and Stack Exchange. Yeah, good to have these kinds of tutorials, because a lot of people probably are wondering, hey, is that even possible? And I have this board, or I'm planning to buy this. So is it possible? And with these tutorials, people can follow them and get the same experience with their favorite OS in the Vision 5 board.
Okay, and then last up, we have a blog post from bq.org, which has got a lot of pictures in it, on terminal latency. And I have strong opinions about this, which I'm going to keep to myself, because I never did anything with the work I did. I've been a long-time user of Xterm. I tried to switch to other terminal emulators several times because of Xterm's broken Unicode support, especially regarding glyphs, emojis, and multi-font substitution. These glyphs are part of many modern CLI tools and are often printed as black squares in Xterm. More recently, I attempted to switch again, but every time I try, I'm discouraged by the additional latency added during typing. I'm not a super fast typist. I average about 80 words a minute for normal text, with bursts for common terminal commands of up to 120 words per minute. The text appears in the terminal, of course, but not as quickly as I would like. There is a noticeable delay, especially when comparing something like Xterm to XFCE4 terminal. I've placed some hope in recent development of GPU accelerated terminals, such as WESTerm, but it felt as slow as XFCE 4 terminals. When I read of the benchmarks, they often show how fast it can print a gigabyte file to standard out, but honestly, this is something I'm not so interested in for everyday use. I found other interesting benchmarks regarding terminal latency, but there were always some terminal emulators missing for which I'd like to know the results, or the results were slightly outdated. For the benchmark, I used Typometer, a tool designed to measure and analyze latency of various applications that have text input. The test does not include keyboard latency or display latency, as Typometer emulates the keystrokes in software, and the screen capture is also in software, not via a physical camera in front of the screen. Hence, you can expect additional latency from the hardware, and these measurements represent only the latency that originated from the software stack. All versions should either be using the latest stable version via Arch Linux or wherever. And then these are a big set of histograms. And I'm going to scroll to the conclusion. I'm quite satisfied with the results, especially now that I've found a decent alternative to XTerm, which only has 1.7 milliseconds more latency. Alcricity, which is the spoiler for the article, I guess. I've seen benchmarks in the past that have measured higher values for Alcricity, hence I think the terminal latency has improved over time due to complaints on GitHub that caught some attention from the maintainers, and a thumbs up on that issue. For now, I'll migrate my configs from XTerm to Alcricity and report back in the form of another blog post. And then there's an update about tweaking for Suckless Terminal, but you can read it if you want to read it. Go find the blog post. It's there. So normally at this point in the show, we would have feedback and questions, and we don't have any lined up, but we do have some feedback which arrived 2 hours ago, which I just want to read. I'm sorry if this breaks the show notes and I forget to put it in. Whatever. So this is feedback from Ian, and the email is titled Trackballs. After the segment on the Kensington trackball in episode 551, I thought I'd write with my trackball experience. I spend way too much time at a computer and have for the last 20 years. Around 5 years ago, I started developing some RSI. I switched the Dvorak keyboard layout to try to mitigate it. It didn't help that much. Though after all the effort, I did stick with it and regained productivity after around a month. I then changed keyboards from a WASDA code to a Kinesis Advantage 2. This helped much more, but I still had some pains. I tried switching to a Logitech vertical mouse. This was a promising idea, but it made it worse. The thing that actually made the most difference was switching to a trackball. I selected the Elecom Huge, a nice trackball from Japan, which, as is advertised, on the larger side. Actually, while it may be huge for Japanese hands, I wish it was a little larger for mine, but I digress. The trackball is great. I went for the wired version so I can use a USB switch to flip my keyboard and trackball between my Mac Pro and my FreeBSD desktop. It works as advertised without any special drivers. The trackball has a 3-speed switch, which I have on medium. There are a few extra buttons, which I don't actually use, but the left click, right click, forward and back buttons, which I use in a browser, are plenty. I can even scroll sideways by pushing on the scroll away, which is accessed by your thumb. All in all, I recommend interest users give it a try. I know Kensington has, like Logitech, been around for decades, and after many years of using Logitech mice, I'm glad I took a chance on something less well-known. It took some getting used to, but now our wrists are much better. Thanks, Ian. I just, like, the subject line won me over. No one else can just send a one-word subject and an exclamation point, and I'll read it. I thought this was spam. But thanks.
Great. It's an issue that a lot of people probably have to face sooner or later, hopefully never. And if that helps, I mean, trackballs and better keyboards go a long way, making your computer experience less painful in terms of typing or interacting, inputting. So, that's our service tweet or service part of this episode. And if you want to write us something, use our feedback at bsdnow.tv email, or go join our BSD Now Telegram channel, which is t.me/bsdnow, with a little bit of a captcha test so that bots stay away from us. And supporting this show is possible via Patreon, patreon.com/bsdnow, where you can ditch in a little bit of money so that we have a bit of newer, you know, gear, and JT can buy food for himself so that he can edit another episode of this podcast.
Say that. JT is not going to starve if people
don't. He's not. He's
He might have to buy one fewer computer.
Very resilient. Like,
he might see, if he saw a Spark laptop or so, he'd buy it. But he might be like looking at a Sun Ultra going, probably shouldn't buy that Sun Ultra.
He's like his own museum curator, right?
Yeah.
He has the collection.
He's like a sensible person.
Yeah. He just needs to create a tour of his own house to make that possible.
That'd be pretty good Patreon-only content. Maybe if we crack some significant number, we can do it, but we'd have to ask him.
Yeah.
He controls the words that come out. It's fine. We can just make promises from him. He can just delete them.
Yeah. He probably puts words in our mouths without us knowing.
JT promises a skull-shaped LED for everyone that backs us on Patreon. No, they're really expensive. They're cool, but they're expensive. No. Skull-shaped LEDs are for people who've earned them.
Are these real skulls or
I mean, it's not going to come across on camera. I've just moved house. I don't know where the Cat 6 is, but I have the skull-shaped LEDs.
You have to show, priorities. You need to keep the important stuff handy.
Wait, I need to find my own camera. Yeah.
Ah, okay, though. Yeah, okay, now I get it. Yeah.
But it's a little skull.
Cool. You never know what comes up when you move from one place to the other.
I mean, Patreon content would be Tom doing a tour of the crap on his desk, but it's gonna be clear. There'll be nothing on it. It'd be a mouse and a keyboard and some chargers. That'll be
The question is, how long will it stay in that state?
There'll be speakers on my desk too, because I don't know where to put them. I can only see 5 computers right now, so I'm doing quite well.
That is, a start, but I guess it will be more.
BSD Now is sponsored by Tarsnap. Everyone needs backups, and Tarsnap ensures that your backups are not only safe, but also secure. Your data is encrypted on your device before being sent to the cloud. You can be sure that only you have the ability to read your data. Tarsnap takes your data and works out what is duplicated. It then assembles the data into compressed blocks and creates them with your local private key. And this key never leaves your system. The data is then uploaded into the cloud. Even if someone is able to obtain your data in the cloud, they will not be able to decrypt it and access your files. Tarsnap is easy to use. If you can use Tar, then you can use Tarsnap. Tarsnap is prepaid, so you never have to worry about an unexpected bill. Tarsnap is fully open source, allowing you to inspect the code and make sure it does what we say it does. Tarsnap has bug bounties so that if you find errors in the code, you can get paid for helping make the software better. With clients on all major platforms, there's no excuse not to have good backups. Go to tarsnap.com to learn more.
Okay, this is the end of the episode, but there will be another next week. I'm fairly sure. I don't have a crystal ball, but I think I will be in there somehow. Until then, enjoy your week, your day, your night, whenever you listen to us, and till next time.
Have a great BSD.
Yeah. The place to be, SD. We haven't mentioned that in a while.
Putting the B in beehive. No, there's a B. Hi, my name's Michael with a B. Yeah.
That's
I need to stop.
Yeah.